You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th. I'm Maddie from Drake University. Here is our first story. Our first local top story is about worker shortage hitting Iowa schools. Worker shortages are impacting nearly every workforce sector, and schools have not been immune, education officials say. Teacher shortages, especially among substitute teachers, are forcing schools across Iowa to make adjustments in order to have enough staff in the building to run a typical school day. In some extreme cases, districts have had to cancel school days because not enough staff has been available. The Rudd-Rockford-Marble Rock Community School District in northern Iowa, for example, was forced to cancel school November 22nd and November 23rd due to an inability to find substitute teachers. The 2 days will be made up at the end of the school year. Trying times, the district secondary principal Nick Johnson said. Iowa's workforce in the category educational services is down 5.4% from pre-pandemic levels, which puts the number of Iowa's education workers at its lowest point in almost a decade, according to state workforce data. The situation in Iowa with teacher substitutes and other staff shortages is dire. Mike Berenick, president of the Iowa State Education Association, a union that represents public schools, teachers, and other education workers across the state, said in a statement, "Chronic underfunding, overcrowded classrooms, and disrespect for the professionals who work with our children every day have driven what we are seeing today. The Iowa State Education Association has been warned about this vortex for years, and we know that fixing it will take a concerted effort by all stakeholders." Lewis Central Community School District is feeling the shortage, Superintendent Eric Nost said. "I would say we continue to struggle to find the ample number of candidates in just about all support staff positions," he said. "Regarding substitute teachers, we are better than we were last year, but we remain short on classroom subs who are willing to work regularly and across all grade levels. The district has managed to recruit some bus drivers, but supply is still tight," Nost said. "We have been able to hire a few drivers, which has helped, but we would still like to have a few more on reserve," he said. "Custodial candidates are still an issue, as are paraeducators and school nutrition staff." Council Bluffs Community School will start the second semester with 2 open teacher positions, according to Dane Ostrowski, Chief Communications Officer. "Our substitute fill rate has been performing well," she said. "We are at a 90% fill rate for classroom teachers and an 85% fill rate for all teachers, which includes counselors, special education resources, and interventionists. However, paraeducators are hard to come by," Ostrowski said. "We are currently recruiting to fill several full-time positions, and our paraeducator substitute pool is much smaller than our substitute teacher pool," she said. "There is a significant competition in the local job market at the paraeducator wage range and an abundance of jobs available between the $14 to $18 wage range. We are offering a $500 sign-on bonus for paraeducators, and we do offer medical insurance." The possible reasons for shortages of teachers, substitutes, and support staff are many, school officials said. According to school officials, enrollment in college education programs is down over the past decade, leading to a shortage of new teachers. The pandemic created for many workers a need for a more flexible working arrangement. Some workers have concerns about being exposed to COVID-19 in the workplace, especially in schools where social distancing is virtually impossible. And in Iowa, a new state law says schools cannot require face masks for staff and students, although that law has been temporarily paused while it's tried in the courts. There seems to be more competition in the job market for paraeducator wages, which are often the $15 per hour range. A general shortage of available workers across the country. Jean Hesberg, public relations specialist for the Iowa State Education Association, said the organization's staff hears all of these issues across the state. "We know most schools are having trouble finding subs. We know most have unfilled positions or have had very few candidates to fill a position," Hesberg said. "And we know we are hearing directly from our members about high burnout, no time in the day because they are covering classrooms for colleagues who are out sick, an increase in tension due to political complaints, and overall frustration over the lack of respect. These issues have all increased over the past 2 years. Most importantly, our educational environment affects both professionals who work in it and the students in their care. We are in crisis. The question is how serious we are about solving it." St. Albert Catholic School officials said the district had been blessed to remain fully staffed in spite of market. "We are fully aware of the nationwide teacher shortage, and we are working very hard to be proactive," middle and high school principal Stephen Eubank said. "We're blessed to have dedicated staff that answer the call, go out of their way to help and support each other and our kids. At this time, we don't have any positions that are open, and part of our diligence is that we are trying to plan ahead for next year, trying to stay one step ahead. But it's really about the dedicated professional teaching staff that we have that answers the bell." Substitute teachers have shown their dedication to the school too, elementary principal Pat Ryan said. We have a core group of substitute teachers who are dedicated to St. Albert, who are willing to go above and beyond, who are part of a community, he said. They've continued to show the dedication this year by sacrificing on their own to help make sure that we run on a regular schedule. Community support also plays a role, President Ann Rowling said. We are very blessed on the Hill to have dedicated teachers who strive for excellence and very supportive community who takes care of our teachers as well, she said. Statewide, most districts have thus far been able to avoid canceling school days, but many have been forced to get creative with staffing issues, officials said. The Sioux City District, for example, is planning to partner with an outside employment firm that specializes in recruiting, hiring, and training substitute teachers and paraeducators. Sioux City Superintendent Paul Geisman said the shortage of substitute teachers in the district has risen to crisis level. The district needs more than 100 additional substitutes, he said. In a district-wide survey, 98% of teachers and 89% of paraeducators said they have been directly impacted or have seen the impact of the substitute teacher shortage. Our staff is overworked, Geisman said. The Waterloo School District is attempting to address its teacher shortage through creative scheduling and hiring permanent substitutes at buildings that have unfilled substitute requests. The district has also asked the state board that oversees educators' qualifications for some leniency in employing long-term substitutes. The shortage has had a significant impact, said Kingsley Botchway II, the Chief Officer of Human Resources and Equity for the Waterloo School District. The Davenport School District has attempted to address its teacher shortage by expanding its worker search beyond the traditional job postings, while staff shuffle its duties and responsibilities daily in order to cover all bases. As a district, we are being impacted by the staffing shortages that are being seen nationwide, including teachers and substitutes, said Nicole Strope, a human resource specialist for the Davenport School District. Whether we are posting on social media, by word of mouth, target recruiting on industrial professionals that could receive career technical certification through the Board of Educational Examiners, or reaching out to department heads of various colleges and universities, we are doing what we can to get the staff we need for the district. Our next story is New Visions begins prep for Christmas celebration. New Visions Homeless Service is preparing for its 28th annual holiday celebration with the help of community volunteers. Brandy Waller, a chief operating officer at New Visions, said the first year they served less than 200 individuals. It was one gift per child, but the need has grown over the years. We served about 4,500 individuals last year, not just from Council Bluffs, but really inclusive to all of Southwest Iowa, Waller said. It's pretty incredible to see our community's generosity. New Visions tries to keep registration open for families until December 15th, but it depends on how many donations there are and how much community involvement. It is one of the few programs that keeps registration open past Thanksgiving, Waller said. We understand a lot of people don't start thinking of Christmas until after Thanksgiving or having all of the November bills paid, she said. We are one of the only programs that adopt kids all the way up to 18 years old, Waller said. Donations for teenagers can include headphones, cologne sets, bath sets, and similar items. We want to make it to where people can give on every level, she said. The celebration will be a drive-through event on Saturday, December 18th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. There will be decorations, cookies, hot chocolate, and of course, Santa Claus. Items for kids and families need to be turned in by December 15th. Volunteers and New Vision staff then place the items in black bags so when given to the families, kids aren't able to see the gifts. It really does take a whole community, so we will use about 500 volunteers, Waller said. Parents are given wrapping paper and tape so they can wrap themselves. Wrapping paper, gift tags, and tape donations are also needed. Waller said they need about 2,000 rolls of wrapping paper. One of the favorite things of our event is that kids get a gift to wrap for their parents as well, Waller said. We want to give on every level, and we know it's important for kids to give too. There will be a celebration on Christmas Day for those experiencing homelessness that are in the apartment complex at New Visions. We wrap up gifts for our guests that stay here and that are in our apartment complex, Waller said. We will hand out Christmas gifts in the morning and have a big holiday meal together that evening. To volunteer, adopt a child or family, register for more information, go to newvisionshs.org. This event really brings our community together, she said. A lot of times when people are experiencing poverty or homelessness, they feel very isolated. So when we have over 500 volunteers throughout the Christmas season, I get to tell our guests to look up. They matter and people want to help them. Our next story is November 30th, Face of the Day, Hannah Williams and Moana the Kitten. There is a picture of a young blonde woman holding a super small, teeny black kitten. Hannah Williams and Moana the Kitten, Hope area animal lovers, are feeling the giving spirit this holiday season in Midlands Humane Society holds its annual Giving Tuesday and Bark Friday fundraisers. Williams, 18, was born and raised in Council Bluffs, where she continues to live this day. A big family has always been a part of her life, as she is one of 12 siblings, both biological and adopted. She graduated from St. Albert High School last year. Williams has been an animal lover who has owned dogs all her life. She has two pups currently, a St. Bernard named Remy and a Labradoodle named Banning. She's also given home to dogs that aren't her own, operating as a foster volunteer for Midlands Humane Society as well. Her sister worked at Midlands a few years ago, and Williams has been working down at the shelter for the last few months too. She said it was a natural fit, and she loves working with both the staff and animals alike. "I've always loved it down here," she said. In other shelter news, as the giving season is upon us this holiday season, Midlands is reminding people that today is Giving Tuesday, sponsored by Share Omaha, as well as TS Bank and Core Bank. Giving Tuesday is an online fundraiser drive that will benefit nonprofits and other organizations on both sides of the river in Omaha Council Bluffs metro area. Midlands Humane Society has three different funds that people can donate to, and the Pottawatomie County Community Foundations will also be providing matching funds. The PCCF will add a 10% contribution to the Frank Faubel Midlands Humane Society Endowment Fund, the Pelton Four Paws Fund, and the Lisa Richter Memorial Fund. More information about Giving Tuesday can be found at shareomaha.org/givingtuesday. The shelter is also in the middle of its annual Bark Friday fundraiser. From now until the end of the year, people can donate their and their contributions will be matched by an anonymous donor. The cap for the donation match is $40,000 this year. More information about fostering, volunteering, and donation opportunities can be found at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org or by calling 712-396-2270. Like their Facebook page to keep up with daily shelter news. The shelter can also be found at Midlands Humane on Twitter and at Midland Humane Society on Instagram. Our next story is DeSoto Boyer Shoot limit other access during antlerless muzzleloader deer hunts. There's a picture of a deer hunting for food on the snow-covered ground at the DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge. DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge will close roads and trails this weekend during an antlerless muzzleloader deer hunt. The hunt will be held from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. Saturday and Sunday. During the hunt weekend, all refuge roads and nature trails will be closed beyond the visitor center to ensure public safety and facilitate a white-tailed deer hunt, a press release from the refuge stated. To accommodate visitors, the visitor center will remain accessible and open from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. both days. Iowa and Nebraska hunters interested in participating should contact Peter Ray at 712-388-4803 or peter_rea@fws.gov. Boyer Chute National Wildlife Refuge will also be hosting a week-long antlerless-only muzzleloader deer hunt from December 4th to December 12th, the press release stated. During this week-long hunt, the refuge will be closed to all other public access. Archery units will remain open for archery hunters, but archery hunters must wear blaze orange to meet state requirements. Nebraska hunters can participate in this week-long antlerless muzzleloader hunt using either a statewide muzzleloader permit or a season choice, Wahoo unit permit. In addition, hunters are required to possess a signed copy of the Boyer Chute Refuge Hunting Regulation and Permit Brochure. These free brochures can be found online at www.fws.gov/refuge/boyer_chute/visit/visitor_activities or at the refuge kiosks. The refuge facilities these hunts in cooperation with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and the Nebraska Game and Parks Commission. Hunting is used as a management tool to control the number of deer on the refuge. Hunting is one of the 6 wildlife-dependent recreational uses on refuges, which also includes wildlife observation, wildlife photography, fishing, environmental education, and interpretation. DeSoto and Boyer Chute are located north of Omaha. DeSoto is located just south of Highway 30 between Missouri Valley and Blair, Nebraska. Boyer Chute, managed by staff at DeSoto, is located east of Highway 75 near Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. Check the website www.fws.gov/refuge/DeSoto or www.fws.gov/refuge/Boyer_Chute. CHUTE for refuge updates. On Facebook, search for DeSoto and Boyer Chute National Wildlife Refuges. For more information, please contact 712-388-4800 or email the refuge at desoto@fws.gov. Our next story is American Red Cross seeks blood donations and financial support. Besides collecting blood for life-giving transfusions, the American Red Cross responds to disasters and global conflict, according to the agency. The Red Cross urges people to visit redcross.org on Giving Tuesday, today, or during the holidays to make a financial contribution or an appointment to give blood or platelets. Individuals can also learn about volunteer opportunities in their area and give back in honor of American Red Cross founder Clara Barton, whose 200th birthday will be commemorated on December 25th. This year has been one of the nation's most active years for severe weather, which battered many communities still reeling from last year's disasters. A sign that climate-driven disasters are compounding the financial hardships of the pandemic, Red Cross officials said in a release. For thousands of people in need, the Red Cross launched a new major relief effort every 11 days to provide refuge, food, and care. Families displaced by a disaster in the U.S. spend an average of almost 30 days in Red Cross-supported emergency shelter. These extended stays were limited due to a lack of savings and community housing shortages. Around the world, massive humanitarian needs engaged in 2021 for a growing number of families displaced by the overlapping challenges of conflict, COVID-19, and climate change. At the request of federal government partners, Red Cross workers from across the country distributed more than 2.1 million essential items, like blankets, diapers, medicine, and toys. For Afghan evacuees arriving on U.S. military bases and unaccompanied children seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. To meet the increasing needs of hospital patients, the Red Cross distributed more than 250,000 more blood products in 2021 than last year, until the Delta variant began to spread again in August. The pandemic also resulted in fewer blood drives at schools and colleges, contributed to a 34% drop in new blood donors, one of the largest year-to-year decreases and one that could threaten essential medical care for patients. As a result of low blood donor turnout in recent months, the Red Cross is heading into the holidays with the lowest blood supply in more than a decade at this time of year. Blood donations are desperately needed now to meet the needs of accident and burn victims, heart surgery and organ transplant patients, and those receiving treatment for leukemia, cancer, or sickle cell disease. All those who come to give November 29th to December 16th will automatically be entered for a chance to win a private screening for the winner and 50 of their guests of the new film, The Matrix Resurrections. Plus, those who come to give November 29th to December 16th will also get a $10 Amazon gift card by mail, thanks to Amazon. Upcoming blood donations opportunities in the area include the following. Pottawatomie County, December 1st, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., AHSTW High School, 768 South Maple, Avoca. Council Bluffs, December 2nd, 8:30 a.m. to 2 p.m., St. Albert High School, 400 Gleason Avenue. December 5th, 7:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., Corpus Christi Catholic Parish Center, 3304 3rd Avenue. December 5th, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive. December 6th, 12 to 5 p.m., Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce, 149 West Broadway. December 7th, 12 to 6 p.m., Green Hills Area Education Agency, 24997 Highway 92. December 9th, 11:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., First Christian Church, 20794 Highway 92. December 13th, 12 to 5 p.m., New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive. December 17th, 11:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Country House Residence, 1831 East Canesville Boulevard. December 20th, 12:30 to 6:30 p.m., Holiday Inn and Suites, 2202 River Road. December 9th, 1 to 6 p.m., Neola Community Center, 110 4th Street, Neola. December 4th, 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., Shelby Community Building, 500 East Street, Shelby. December 16th, 11:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Community Center, 11 West Main Street, Trainer. For Cass County, there is a drive December 8th, 8:30 a.m. to 2 p.m., Cam High School, 1000 Victory Park Road, Anita. For Fremont County, December 16th, 11:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Sydney United Faith Church, 1975 Highway 275, Sydney. For Harrison County, December 8th, 12:30 to 6 p.m., St. Patrick Church, 312 South 3rd Street, Dunlap. December 23rd, 12 to 6 p.m., Rand Community / Senior Center, 100 South 4th Street, Missouri Valley. For Mills County, December 6th, 6:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., Glenwood High School, 504 East Sharp Street, Glenwood. For Montgomery County, December 17th, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., Viking Center, 501 Elliott Stanton. For Page County, December 22nd, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Lyde Center, 1140 East Main, Clarinda. Shelby County, December 6th, 12 to 6 p.m., St. Joseph's Hall, 118 Main Street, Erling. And December 1st, 12 to 6 p.m., St. Mary's Parish Center, 204 Street, Mary Avenue, Panama. Our next story, Biden vaccine rule for health workers blocked in 10 states, including Iowa. Jefferson City, Missouri. A federal judge on Monday blocked President Joe Biden's administration from enforcing a coronavirus vaccine mandate on thousands of healthcare workers in 10 states that had brought the first legal challenge against the requirement. The court order said the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid had no clear authority from Congress to enact the vaccine mandate for providers participating in the two government healthcare programs for the elderly, disabled, and poor. The preliminary injunction by St. Louis-based U.S. District Judge Matthew Shelp applies to a coalition of suing states that includes Iowa, Nebraska, Alaska, Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. All those states have either a Republican attorney general or governor. Similar lawsuits are also pending in other states. The federal rule requires COVID-19 vaccinations for more than 17 million workers nationwide in about 76,000 healthcare facilities and home healthcare providers that get funding from the government health programs. Workers are to receive their first dose by December 6th and their second shot by January 4th. The court order against the healthcare vaccine mandate comes after Biden's administration suffered a similar setback for a broader policy. A federal court previously placed a hold on separate rule requiring businesses with more than 100 employees to ensure their workers get vaccinated or else wear masks and get tested weekly for the coronavirus. Biden's administration contends federal rules supersede state policies prohibiting vaccine mandates and are essential to slowing the pandemic, which has killed more than 775,000 people in the U.S. About three-fifths of the U.S. population is already vaccinated. But the judge in the health provider case wrote that the federal officials likely overstepped their legal powers. CMS seeks to overtake an area of traditional state authority by imposing an unprecedented demand to federally dictate the private medical decisions of millions of Americans. Such action challenges traditional notions of federalism, Shelp wrote in his order. Even under an exceedingly broad interpretation of federal powers, Congress did not clearly authorize CMS to enact this politically and economically vast federalism-altering and boundary-pushing mandate, wrote Shelp, who was appointed to the bench by former President Donald Trump. While a vaccine requirement might make sense for long-term care facilities, Shelp wrote, CMS lacks evidence for imposing it on other healthcare providers and ignored evidence that the mandate could jeopardize understaffed facilities. The judge also said CMS improperly bypassed public notice and comment requirements when issuing the emergency rule, which feeds into the very vaccine hesitancy CMS acknowledges is so daunting. Officials at CMS had no immediate comment about the preliminary injunction. Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt, who superseded the lawsuit, said the ruling pushes back on the overreach of power by those who are using coronavirus as a tool for control over other people. Our last local story is called Reynolds Row, Tragic Incoherent. Des Moines Republican Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa and Kristi Noem of South Dakota on Monday reiterated their hope that an upcoming U.S. Supreme Court case will begin the process of overturning a landmark 1973 decision that protected Americans' abortion rights. During a briefing hosted by the anti-abortion rights group Susan B. Anthony List, Noem spoke and Reynolds delivered a recorded message. Reynolds called Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a 1992 ruling that affirmed Roe, tragic and incoherent. Oral arguments in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which centers on a new anti-abortion rights law in Mississippi, are scheduled to be conducted Wednesday. At the heart of the case is whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional. With Dobbs, the Supreme Court can strike a blow for democratic self-government, restore constitutional integrity, and right historic wrongs, Reynolds said in her recorded message. Reynolds earlier this year joined Republican governors in asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, and in her own request asked the Iowa Supreme Court to overturn its recent ruling that protected abortion rights in the state. She also signed two bills that would have required a waiting period before a woman could get an abortion, but both were struck down by the courts. Noam called the latest U.S. Supreme Court case the most important oral argument that we will have in decades. Conservatives who have prioritized limiting or eliminating legal abortions have hoped that a newly conservative U.S. Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade. Republican former President Donald Trump appointed three justices during his lone term in office, giving the high court a 6-3 conservative majority. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Maddie from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Here is an opinion piece by Richard Kite, How to Learn to Be Thankful One Story at a Time. Sometimes after school, I would hop on my bike and ride across town to my grandpa's house. I would find him sitting in his recliner next to the oxygen tank. His hand, cruelly deformed by rheumatoid arthritis, would reach out to me. I would take it gently in mine and ask, "How are you doing today?" "Just reliving my life," he would say, and then he would tell a story. He might talk about his hobo days hopping freight cars from Chicago to Montana, or of running moonshine from the Iowa bootleggers to the speakeasies in St. Paul, Minnesota. Or he might talk about the hard times after the aneurysm that struck him down when he was in his 30s, leaving him unemployed and his family destitute. But he would not dwell on the hardship. Instead, he would talk about his friends who, when deer season came along, loaded him into the car and brought him to deer camp. At the time, he could neither walk nor talk, but they sat him in a chair in the woods, a sawhorse serving as a gun rest so he could shoot with one hand. Each hour or so, one of his buddies would stop by to make sure he hadn't fallen out of the chair. Whatever the story is, it always ended in the same way. He would lean back with a big smile and sigh. "It's been a good life." It was hard for me to see how. He had grown up poor, the little he had stripped from him, first by the Great Depression and then by the aneurysm that paralyzed his left side and left him homeless. But gratitude, I have since learned, has little to do with what happens to us and everything to do with how we see the world. Robert Emmons, the world's foremost researcher on gratitude, writes that gratitude has two components. The first is affirming goodness. The second is recognizing that goodness comes from outside ourselves. Virtues begin in imitation, doing what we see modeled by those we love. That imitation, when practiced daily, becomes a habit. Eventually, the habit shapes our perception, so we begin to see the world the way the person we imitate sees it. This is why most virtues are not explicitly taught. They are passed along as gifts. Gratitude, more than any other virtue, is handed down in families by the stories we tell. We look for the goodness in our lives, reflect upon it, and then talk about it, highlighting certain features of the world and obscuring others. Now that I am one of the older members of the family, I feel the responsibility of tending to the stories, not just so my children and nieces and nephews know the stories, but just so that they know how to tell their own stories, how to attend to their own lives so they do not become lost, mired in distraction and despair. I do not want them to become the sort of person who thinks life is just one damn thing after another, or who thinks self-improvement happens as a result of first taking care of one's problems. There is no end to problems. At this time of year, when the family gathers together, I feel the responsibility intensely, but I know what will happen. Chaos will ensue. A football game will be blaring from the TV in the living room, somebody will spill the gravy, Gary will have one too many beers and start talking politics, my sister's dog will have an accident in the hallway, and my wife and I will drive home relieved to have survived another holiday get-together. But then I recall that I never learned my grandparents' stories during the hustle and bustle of the holidays. I listen to their stories over a cup of coffee at the kitchen table when the house is quiet, or sitting in the porch as the shadows grew long. Stories are best when both teller and listener have time and attention. A few months ago, I asked my mother if I could record some of her stories. We scheduled a series of meetings on Zoom. I sat at my kitchen table in Wisconsin, she at hers in northern Minnesota. We had coffee and talked. She told me stories about my grandparents that I had never heard or had forgotten. She told me about her childhood, about the summer they couldn't leave the farm because there had been a case of polio in town. She told me about living in a chicken coop one winter when she was 5 years old and about attending a one-room school. She told me why she decided to become a nurse. After she finished her last story, she sat back in her chair, gazed into the screen, and said, "It's been a good life." We have these stories now posted on a YouTube channel so that kids in our family can watch them if they have the time and attention. I hope they do. The other day, a friend asked me what I was thankful for. It occurred to me, I am most thankful for having parents and grandparents who showed me how to see the world with love. They entrusted me to pass that gift on to the next generation. one story at a time. Now it's time for today's obituaries. Phyllis P. Davis. Phyllis P. Davis, age 95, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 26, 2021, at Bethany Lutheran Home. Phyllis was born October 4, 1926, in Harrison County, Iowa, to the late Caleb J. and Arietta J. Newsom. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1943. Phyllis was married to Donald Sampson until his passing in 1968. She married Norrin L. Davis, Sr. on December 28, 1971, in Omaha. Phyllis retired from Iowa Power and Light as a secretary for the general manager of the West Division after many years of service. She was a member of St. John Lutheran Church, chapter number 441, OES, Daughters of the Nile and American Legion Auxiliary. In addition to her parents and first husband, Phyllis was preceded in death by a daughter and son, sister Loretta Robertson in 2011 and stepson Norrin Davis Jr. Phyllis is survived by her husband of 49 years, Norrin L. Davis, Sr., stepson Bradford Davis, stepdaughter Melinda Bird, all of Council Bluffs, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, two nieces and their families, and many friends. Funeral service Thursday, 11 a.m. at St. John Lutheran Church. Interment Cedar Lawn Cemetery with a launch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Thursday at the church. Memorials are suggested to St. John Lutheran Church or St. Croix Hospice. Elizabeth Dishman. Elizabeth Dishman, age 28, passed away November 25, 2021. She was born November 24, 1993, to Joel and Rachel Stearns in Omaha, Nebraska. She was preceded in death by mother Rachel Hopper, grandfathers Robert Koletsky and James Stearns. Elizabeth is survived by her husband, Wendell Dishman, father, Joel Stearns, brother, Cody Stearns, grandmothers, Carol Koletsky and Jean Stearns, step-grandparents, Leroy and Mary Ann Crackle, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. The family will direct memorials. Ralph Head. Ralph Head, age 85, passed away at Methodist Hospital November 27, 2021. He was born November 17, 1936, to the late Chester and Ruby Head in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School with the class of 1955 and then proudly served his country in the United States Army. He retired from AT&T. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his siblings, Chester Aaron and Charles Head and Dolores Kane. Ralph is survived by his wife of 42 years, Clara Head, nieces, nephews, and cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Friday, December 3rd, 2021. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery on Saturday, December 4th, 2021. Family and friends will meet at the funeral home at 9:45 and go in procession to the cemetery. The family will direct memorials. John R. Heinlein. John R. Heinlein, age 74, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 27, 2021 at Chi Mercy Hospital. John was born March 30, 1947 in Brooklyn, New York to the late Roy and Irene Heinlein. He is survived by his former wife and caretaker, Wend Hamilton, daughter Samantha Heinlein and son John A. Heinlein. Sisters Carol and Cow of Jupiter, Florida, and Irene Betty of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Niece Susie Fitzgerald. Nephews Garrett and Owen Fitzgerald. Joe and Danny Beatty and Slider the Cat. Graveside service and burial Tuesday, 10 a.m. in Memorial Park Cemetery. Family and friends to meet at Cutler O'Neill. Ella May Bunny McCoy. Ella May Bunny McCoy, age 77, passed away at Chi Medical Mercy Hospital November 26, 2021. She was born June 21, 1944, to the late George and Ella May Gloop in Omaha, Nebraska. Bunny graduated from South High School and with the class of 1962. She was a longtime hairdresser in Council Bluffs. Bunny is survived by her husband, Roger McCoy, children Lisa, Brian, Robert McCoy, and Greg McCoy. Grandchildren Blake McCoy, Madison McCoy, Olivia McCoy, Reese McCoy, Sawyer McCoy, and Dane McCoy. Siblings Molly Kelly, Roy Gloop, and Linda Galloway, a host of other family and friends. Visitations will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy
Kalnowski Funeral Home on Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church on Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. Intermittent is in Garner Township Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the church. Edith McDaniel. Edith McDaniel, 99, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away on Friday, November 26, 2021, at the Bethany Lutheran Home in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Private family services are being held with burial in the Carson Cemetery in Carson, Iowa. Lois Hill's funeral home in Carson is caring for Edith and her family. Edith is preceded in death by her parents, husband, Ross, brother, Everett, Sonny, Caldwell, sister, Verna Baxter. Edith is survived by her children, Gary McDaniel and his wife, Linda, of Buckeye, Arizona. Wayne McDaniel and his wife Karen of La Vista, Nebraska, Alan McDaniel and his wife Pat of Ames, Iowa, Rhonda Clark and her husband David of Ralston, Nebraska, 6 children, 7 great-grandchildren, other relatives, and a host of many friends. Sigrid Stouffer. Sigrid Stouffer, 73, passed away peacefully on November 25, 2021 in Fort Myers, Florida after a courageous battle with breast cancer. She was a devoted wife, a loving mother, and a proud grandmother. Throughout her life, Sigrid remains a nurturing sister and steadfast friend to those lucky enough to call her friend. She was born to Walter and Ilse Wolf on November 13, 1948, in Wolfbüttel, Germany. She and her family immigrated to Council Bluffs, Iowa when she was in elementary school. Because she did not speak English, Sigrid was placed in kindergarten class. This motivated her to learn the language quickly, enabling her to advance to her age-appropriate grade. To avoid being teased, she spent many hours practicing in front of a mirror until she could speak perfect English without a German accent. She never lost her connection to Germany and traveled there often to visit relatives. Sigrid is survived by her husband Richard, her 2 sons Bill and Brian, her grandchildren Mason, Riley, Nathan, and Drew, her brother George Wolf, and her sister Kathy Wolftek. After graduating from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1968, she delayed further education for herself so she could support her husband through his college years. She didn't need a formal education to be one smart lady. She was self-taught and diligently studied everything she needed to know. Sigrid and her husband Richard were married for 54 years. He describes her as the wind beneath his wings. She was a true partner and helpmate in every endeavor, whether as his front person in his accounting and banking careers, his assistant in the rental home business, or as a hostess at social affairs. She had the ability to be covered in paint and dust during the day, go home to clean up, and be dressed for the evening as the elegant lady she was. She devoted countless hours of service to the community church through the Council Bluffs Service League, PEO, and the First Congregational Church. Sigrid was a longtime Sunday school teacher, impacting the lives of many children. Although she was small in stature, her strength was mighty, evidenced by her prowess in bowling, golf, and arm wrestling. She also enjoyed playing bridge, reading music, dancing, and beachcombing. She loved spending winters in Florida with her many friends at The Forest in Fort Myers. Her love of life was evident in the way she lived. She never met a stranger and enlivened any occasion with her warm smile and signature laugh. She touched many lives and made all she encountered feel important and special. She will always be remembered and missed by all those who were fortunate to know her. Memorials requested to Hope Hospice, 9470 Health Park Circle, Fort Myers, Florida, 33908. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Ohio court to hear NASCAR challenge of tax on broadcasts. Columbus, Ohio. The Ohio Supreme Court has scheduled oral arguments in a case involving the state's attempt to tax NASCAR for broadcasting its races in Ohio. At issue before the court is whether the state tax commissioner properly subjected those broadcasts to Ohio's commercial activities tax during an audit from 2005 to 2010. The tax requires payments on a company's annual sales. Oral arguments have been set for January 25th. The state argues its imposing of the tax is based on NASCAR's commercial activity, meaning the organization's sale of Ohio broadcast rights. NASCAR could avoid the issues by excluding Ohio from its licensing contract, the state said in a September court filing, but as long as Ohio is included in its licensing agreements, Ohio is relevant to NASCAR's receipts, the Ohio Attorney General Office said. The tax commissioner determined NASCAR owed Ohio $549,520, according to court records. Dayton Beach, Florida-based NASCAR maintains that its commercial activities in Ohio, such as broadcasting races and selling merchandise, are done by other companies, Fox Broadcasting Company, for example, which are taxed accordingly. Applying the tax to NASCAR broadcast in Ohio is an unconstitutional expansion of tax liability for out-of-state content providers, NASCAR argued in August filing. Braves exercise 2024 option for manager Brian Snitker. Here there's a picture of manager of the Atlanta Braves, Brian Snitker, as he celebrates the team's victory during a victory parade. He's wearing a jersey and a hat and some sunglasses, and it looks like he's sitting in a car or the back of a pickup truck with his arms waving, and looks like he's celebrating. So, Atlanta. The Atlanta Braves have locked up manager Brian Snicker for three seasons after he guided the team to his first World Series title since 1995. The Braves announced Tuesday they have exercised the option for the 2024 season on Snicker's contract, an expected move for the highly popular skipper who already had two more years on his current deal. The 66-year-old Snicker is a Braves lifer, having spent more than four decades in the organization in various roles before he finally landed the big league managing job during the 2016 season after Freddy Gonzalez was fired. Snicker has guided the Braves to four straight NL East titles, capped by this season's surprising run to the World Series championship after the club went 88-73 during the regular season, the fewest wins of any postseason team. The Braves upset Milwaukee in the division round, knocked off the 106-win Los Angeles Dodgers in the NL Champion Series, and defeated the Houston Astros in a six-game World Series. Snicker has a record of 441-390 in six seasons as a manager. EU wants verifiable proof Chinese tennis player is safe. Here there is a picture of China's Peng Shuai as she waves to a crowd after losing to Canada's Eugenie Bouchard in their first-round match at the Australian Open Tennis Championships in Melbourne, Australia in 2019. Brussels. The European Union said Tuesday that it wants China to release verifiable proof that tennis player Peng Shuai is safe and to conduct a thorough and transparent investigation into her sexual assault allegations. Peng, a three-time Olympian and former top-ranked doubles player, dropped out of public view after accusing a former Communist Party official of sexual assault. Peng only had a few direct contacts with this official outside of China since she disappeared from public view earlier this month. She told Olympic officials in a November 21st call from Beijing that she was safe and well. Her recent public reappearance does not ease concerns about her safety and freedom, an EU spokesperson said. Peng made the sexual assault allegations online against a former member of the Communist Party's ruling standing committee, Zhang Guali. The tennis player's post was removed within minutes and she stopped appearing in public. The EU joins growing international demands, included by sports professionals, for assurance that she is free and not under threat, the EU said in a statement. In this spirit, the EU requests the Chinese government to provide verifiable proof of Peng Shuai's safety, well-being, and whereabouts. The EU urges the Chinese authorities to conduct a full, fair, and transparent investigation into her allegations of sexual assault. Peng adds to the growing number of Chinese business people, activists, and ordinary people who have disappeared from public view in recent years after criticizing party figures or in crackdowns on corruption or pro-democracy and labor rights campaigns. The EU strongly opposes the use of practice of enforced disappearance and arbitrary detention and calls upon China to comply with its human rights obligations under national and international law, the EU said. Carolina Panthers running back Christian McCaffrey to miss the remainder of the season. Here there's a picture of Miami Dolphins linebacker Duke Riley tackling Carolina Panthers running back Christian McCaffrey during the first half at Hard Rock Stadium, Sunday, November 28th in Miami, Florida. It looks like he is getting him from behind and about to take him down for a tackle. Panthers star running back Christian McCaffrey is headed back to injured reserve, the team announced Monday. He'll miss the remainder of the year. McCaffrey suffered an ankle injury in the first half of the Panthers game against the Dolphins and was seen leaving Hard Rock Stadium in a walking boot. It's unclear at what point he suffered the injury, but he only played in one snap in the second half. He rolled his ankle as he was trying to go in the second half but was never quite able to come back to the same level, Panthers coach Matt Rhule said Sunday. Rhule said Monday morning that McCaffrey had an x-ray on the ankle Sunday night, which came back negative, but it wouldn't know more until later. An MRI on Monday revealed that the injury was severe enough to place him on IR. The injury will not require surgery, provided it heals properly, according to a source with knowledge of the injury. McCaffrey's final rushing attempt came with 4:26 left in the second quarter. He was stood up at the line of scrimmage and never went down. However, he was subbed out of the game and cameras caught him grimacing on the sideline. McCaffrey's injury is a major blow to the Panthers, whose season already hangs in the balance. They are 5-7 and have lost two consecutive games. Seven NFC teams will make the playoffs this season. The Panthers are currently 11th in the standings and are one game behind the 7th place team. They suffered perhaps their worst loss Sunday to the Dolphins, 33-10, in a game where the offense wasn't productive. The Panthers had 198 total yards. McCaffrey, who did not have a rushing attempt in the second half, finished with 10 rushes for 35 yards and no catches. His zero-catch performance was the first time he has had a single reception in a game in his 5-year career. When McCaffrey is at his best, so are the Panthers. Because of that, they made him sign the highest-paid running back in NFL history in April 2020, signing him to a four-year, $64 million contract extension. His contract runs through the 2025 season. The Panthers are 3-0 this season when he touches the ball 20 times or more. Before the 2020 season, McCaffrey hadn't missed a single game in 3 years and played the majority of the team's snaps. But in the past 2 years, McCaffrey has spent more time off the field than he has on it. In 2020, he suffered an ankle sprain in week two and missed the next 6 games. When he returned, he suffered an AC shoulder joint injury in week 9 and missed the next 3 games. He was supposed to return after the team's bye week in week 13, but suffered a quad injury while rehabbing and did not play in the final 4 games. In 2021, he suffered a hamstring injury in week 3, causing him to miss 5 games, and now he has the latest ankle injury in week 12. McCaffrey has missed 18 games in his career because of injuries. By the end of the regular season, McCaffrey will have missed 23 games in 2 years. When McCaffrey is not in the lineup, his loss is felt. In the 5 games without McCaffrey this season, the Panthers are 1-4. In the 7 games with him, they're 4-3. McCaffrey has 442 yards rushing on 99 carries and 1 rushing touchdown this season. He also had 37 receptions for 343 yards and a receiving touchdown. Now the Panthers will have to once again prepare without him. Quarterback Cam Newton, who the Panthers signed earlier this month, is still learning the offensive system, will be without his best weapon. The Panthers will likely lean on rookie running back Chuba Hubbard and backup Amir Abdullah, who have split backup roles in recent weeks. Hubbard has 427 yards rushing on 122 carries and 3 rushing touchdowns. He also has 19 receptions for 152 yards. Abdullah, who the Panthers signed in October, has 95 yards rushing on 28 carries and 16 receptions for 129 yards between Carolina and Minnesota, his previous team. Report. Texas Rangers shortstop Corey Seager agrees to 10-year, $325 million deal. So here's a picture of Los Angeles Dodgers shortstop Corey Seager preparing to catch a ball while underneath him, Atlanta Braves' Eddie Rosario attempts to steal second base during the third inning in Game 5 of the 2021 National League Championship Series at Dodger Stadium. The Texas Rangers are still at it, and in a big way. The team has agreed to terms with shortstop Corey Seager on a 10-year, $325 million deal, according to ESPN's Jeff Passan. The deal would make Seager one of the highest-paid players in the league. On Sunday, the Rangers signed infielder Marcus Semien, right-handed pitcher John Gray, and outfielder Cole Calhoun. None of the deals have been officially announced by the club. Seager, 27, with his .306, with 16 home runs, 22 doubles, and 57 RBIs in 95 games in 2020, his 7th season for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Seager was the 18th overall pick in the 2012 MLB draft. He's a career .297 hitter with .870 OPS in his 7 seasons. With the 4 acquisitions, the Rangers have committed more than $560 million. It's more than twice the second closest team, the Mets, who have spent more than $250 million. The Rangers are the first team to commit $500 million in a single season on 2 or fewer players, according to the ESPN stats and info. Semien's 7-year deal is worth $175 million, according to multiple reports. Semien, who played shortstop during his seasons with the Athletics, played primarily at second base for the Blue Jays in 2021. With Seager joining the roster, Semien is likely to be the Rangers' primary second baseman in 2022. Speaking of the Mets, Scherzer and Mets agree to a $130 million 3-year contract. Max Scherzer has shattered baseball records for highest average salary, agreeing Monday to a $130 million 3-year contract with the New York Mets. A person familiar with the negotiations told the Associated Press, "The person spoke on condition of anonymity because the agreement is subject to successful physical. The $43.33 million average salary is 20% higher than the previous mark. The $36 million Yankees pitcher Gerrit Cole is averaging in his $324 million 9-year contract with New York. Scherzer would have the right to opt out after the 2023 season to become a free agent once again. Scherzer also receives a full no-trade provision requiring his approval for any deals. The agreement also includes award bonuses. Scherzer lives in West Palm Beach, Florida, about an hour drive from the Mets' spring training complex in Port St. Lucie. He's planning to take a physical Monday that is needed for the deal to be complete. A 3-time Young Award winner and eight-time All-Star, the 37-year-old right-hander was 15-4 with a 24.6 ERA last season for the Washington Nationals and Los Angeles Dodgers, who acquired him on July 30th. He struck out 236 and walked 36 in 179 one-third innings, averaging 94.4 miles per hour with his fastball in the final season of $210 million 7-year contract that included $105 million in deferred money payable from 2022 to 2028. He is 190-97 with a 3.16 ERA and 14 major league seasons for Arizona, 2008 to 2009. Detroit, 2010 to 2014, in Washington, and the Dodgers. He has distinctive eyes, blue on the right, brown on the left, a condition known as heterochromia iridis. A workhorse who helped the Nationals win the 2019 World Series, Scherzer won the AL Cy Young in 2013 and consecutive NL Cy Youngs in 2016 and 2017. He finished third in this year's voting behind Milwaukee's Corbin Burns and Philadelphia's Zach Wheeler. Scherzer gets $43 million annually. The Mets deal will raise his career earnings to more than $370 million. He joins a rotation headed by two-time Cy Young Award winner Jacob deGrom, who didn't pitch after July 7th because of right forearm tightness. Carlos Carrasco and Taijuan Walker also return under club control. Noah Syndergaard returned from Tommy John surgery and left for a $21 million one-year contract with the Los Angeles Angels. The Mets lost out on left-hander Steven Matz, whose $44 million four-year contract with the St. Louis Cardinals was to be finalized Monday. New York also has pending deals with center fielder Starling Marte, $78 million for 4 years, outfielder/first baseman Mark Canha, and infielder Eduardo Escobar, all contingent on successful physicals. The Mets had baseball's third-highest payroll on August 31st at $196 million, trailing the Dodgers' $261 million, and Yankees' $204 million. They can emerge as the top spender following their first full offseason under owner Stephen Cohen, who bought the team in November 2020 from the Wilpon and Katz families in a deal that valued the Mets at a baseball record $2.42 billion. As baseball heads to a likely lockout when the collective bargaining agreement expires Wednesday night, Scherzer is a member of the union's 8-player executive subcommittee. His agreement, like Cole's, was negotiated by agent Scott Boras. Steelers place star linebacker T.J. Watt on COVID-19 list. Here there's a picture of Pittsburgh Steelers outside linebacker T.J. Watt, who pushes Isaiah Prince from the Cincinnati Bengals as he tries to rush pass during the second half of an NFL football game. The Pittsburgh Steelers have placed star outside linebacker T.J. Watt on the COVID-19 list. The team made the announcement on Monday, a day after the Steelers were embarrassed 41-10 on the road in Cincinnati. Watt is the third high-profile member of the Steelers to go on the COVID-19 list in recent weeks. Quarterback Ben Roethlisberger and safety Minka Fitzpatrick went on the COVID-19 protocol earlier this month. Roethlisberger sat out practice after going on the list on October 13th and missed a tie with Detroit. He participated virtually the following week and returned to play in a loss at the Los Angeles Chargers. Fitzpatrick did not play against the Chargers after going onto the list on October 15th. Watt's 12.5 sacks rank second in the NFL, but he was limited to just 2 tackles against Cincinnati while dealing with hip and knee injuries suffered against the Lions. Watt's potential absence is the latest setback for Pittsburgh's reeling defense. Veteran defensive linemen Tyson Alula and Stephon Tuitt are out with injuries, and inside linebacker Robert Spillane left on Sunday with a knee injury and did not return. The Steelers host AFC North, leading Baltimore 8-3 next Sunday. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 30th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Maddie Clevenger from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.